Captive Market. Saturday morning, about 11 o'clock, Mrs. Edna Berthelsen was ready to make her little trip. Although it was a weekly affair consuming 4 hours of her valuable business time, she made the profitable trip alone, preserving for herself the integrity of her find. Because that was what it was, a find, a stroke of incredible luck. There was nothing else like it, and she had been in business 53 years. More if the years in her father's store were counted, but they didn't really count. That had been for the experience, her father made that clear. No pay was involved. But it gave her the understanding of business, the feel of operating a small country store, dusting pencils and unwrapping flypaper and serving up dried beans and chasing the cat out of the Cracker Barrel where he liked to sleep. Now the store was old, and so was she. The big, heavy-set, black-browed man who was her father had died long ago. Her own children and grandchildren had been spawned, had crept out over the world, were everywhere. One by one they had appeared, lived in Walnut Creek, sweated through the dry, sun-baked summers, and then gone on, leaving one by one as they had come. She in the store sagged and settled a little more each year, became a little more frail and stern and grim, a little more themselves. That morning, very early, Jackie said, "Grandma, where are you going?" Although he knew, of course, where she was going out in her truck as she always did. This was the Saturday trip, but he liked to ask. He was pleased by the stability of the answer. He liked having it always the same. To another question, there was another unvarying answer, but this one didn't please him so much. It came in answer to the question, "Can I come along?" The answer to that was always no. Edna Berthelsen laboriously carried packages and boxes from the back of the store to the rusty upright pickup truck. Dust lay over the truck. Its red metal sides were bent and corroded. The motor was already on. It was wheezing and heating up in the midday sun. A few drab chickens pecked in the dust around its wheels. Under the porch of the store, a plump, white, shaggy sheep squatted, its face vapid, indolent, indifferently watching the activity of the day. Cars and trucks rolled along Mount Diablo Boulevard. Along Lafayette Avenue, a few shoppers strolled, farmers and their wives, petty businessmen, farmhands, some city women in their gaudy slacks and print shirts, sandals, bandanas. In the front of the store, the radio tinnily played popular songs. "I asked you a question," Jackie said righteously. "I asked you where you're going." Mrs. Berthelsen bent stiffly over to lift the last armload of boxes. Most of the loading had been done the night before by Arnie, the Swede, the hulking, white-haired man who did the heavy work around the store. "What?" she murmured vaguely, her gray, wrinkled face twisting with concentration. "You know perfectly well where I'm going." Jackie trailed plaintively after her as she re-entered the store to look for her order book. "Can I come? Please, can I come along? You never let me come. You never let anybody come." "Of course not," Mrs. Berthelsen said sharply. "It's nobody's business." "But I want to come along," Jackie explained. Slyly, the little old woman turned her gray head and peered back at him, a worn, colorless bird taking in a world perfectly understood. "So does everybody else." Thin lips twitching in a secret smile, Mrs. Berthelsen said softly, "But nobody can." Jackie didn't like the sound of that. Sullenly he retired to a corner, hands stuck deep in the pockets of his jeans, not taking part in something that was denied him, not approving of something in which he could not share. Mrs. Berthelsen ignored him. She pulled her frayed blue sweater around her thin shoulders, located her sunglasses, pulled the screen door shut after her, and strode briskly to the truck. Getting the truck into gear was an intricate process. For a time she sat tugging crossly at the shift, pumping the clutch up and down, waiting impatiently for the teeth to fall into place. At last, screeching and chattering, the gears meshed. The truck leaped a little, and Mrs. Berthelsen gunned the motor and released the handbrake. As the truck roared jerkily down the highway, Jackie detached himself from the shade by the house and followed along after it. His mother was nowhere in sight. Only the dozing sheep and the two scratching chickens were visible. Even Arnie the Swede was gone, probably getting a cold Coke. Now was a fine time. Now was the best time he had ever had. And it was going to be sooner or later anyhow, because he was determined to come along. Grabbing hold of the tailboard of the truck, Jackie hoisted himself up and landed face down on the tightly packed heaps of packages and boxes. Under him, the truck bounced and bumped. Jackie hung on for dear life. Clutching at the boxes, he pulled his legs under him, crouched down, and desperately sought to keep from being flung off. Gradually, the truck righted itself, and the torque diminished. He breathed a sigh of relief and settled gratefully down. He was on his way. He was along, finally. Accompanying Mrs. Berthelsen on her secret weekly trip, her strange covert enterprise from which, he had heard, she made a fabulous profit. A trip which nobody understood, and which he knew in the deep recesses of his child's mind was something awesome and wonderful, something that would be well worth the trouble. He had hoped fervently that she wouldn't stop to check her load along the way. With infinite care, Tellman prepared himself a cup of coffee. First, he carried a tin cup of roasted grain over to the gasoline drum the colony used as a mixing bowl. Dumping it in, he hurried to add a handful of chicory and a few fragments of dried bran. Dirt-stained hands trembling, he managed to get a fire started among the ashes and coals under the pitted metal grate. He set a pan of tepid water on the flames and searched for a spoon. "What are you up to?" his wife demanded from behind him. Tellman muttered. Nervously, he edged between Gladys and the meal. "Just fooling around." In spite of himself, his voice took on a nagging whine. "I have a right to fix myself something, don't I? As much right as anybody else." "You ought to be over helping." "I was. I wrenched something in my back." The wiry, middle-aged man ducked uneasily away from his wife. Tugging at the remains of his soiled white shirt, he retreated toward the door of the shack. "Damn it! A person has to rest sometimes." "Rest when we get there." Gladys wearily brushed back her thick, dark blonde hair. "Suppose everybody was like you." Tellman flushed resentfully. "Who plotted our trajectory? Who's done all the navigation work?" A faint, ironic smile touched his wife's chapped lips. "We'll see how your charts work out," she said. "Then we'll talk about it." Enraged, Tellman plunged out of the shack into the blinding late afternoon sunlight. He hated the sun, the sterile white glare that began at 5 in the morning and lasted until 9 in the evening. The big blast had sizzled the water vapor from the air. The sun beat down pitilessly, sparing nobody. But there were few left to care. To his right was the cluster of shacks that made up the camp. An eclectic hodgepodge of boards, sheets of tin, wire and tar paper, upright concrete blocks, anything and everything dragged from the San Francisco ruins 40 miles west. Cloth blankets flapped dismally in doorways, protection against the vast hosts of insects that swept across the campsite from time to time. Birds, the natural enemy of insects, were gone. Talman hadn't seen a bird in 2 years, and he didn't expect to see one again. Beyond the camp began the eternal dead black ash, the charred face of the world, without features, without life. The camp had been set up in a natural hollow. One side was sheltered by the tumbled ruins of what had once been a minor mountain range. The concussion of the blast had burst the towering cliffs. Rock had cascaded into the valley for days. After San Francisco had been fired out of existence, survivors had crept into the heaps of boulders, looking for a place to hide from the sun. That was the hardest part, the unshielded sun. Not the insects, not the radioactive clouds of ash, not the flashing white fury of the blasts, but the sun. More people had died of thirst and dehydration and blind insanity than from toxic poisons. From his breast pocket, Talman got a precious package of cigarettes. Shakily, he lit up. His thin, claw-like hands were trembling, partly from fatigue, partly from rage and tension. How he hated the camp. He loathed everybody in it, his wife included. Were they worth saving? He doubted it. Most of them were barbarians already. What did it matter if they got the ship off or not? He was sweating away his mind and life trying to save them. The hell with them. But then, his own safety was involved with theirs. He stalked stiff-legged over to where Barnes and Masterson stood talking. "How's it coming?" he demanded gruffly. "Fine," Barnes answered. "It won't be long now." "One more load," Masterson said. His heavy features twitched uneasily. "I hope nothing gets fouled up. She ought to be here any minute." Talman loathed the sweaty, animal-like scent that rolled from Masterson's beefy body. Their situation wasn't an excuse to creep around, filthy as a pig. On Venus, things would be different. Masterson was useful, now. He was an experienced mechanic, invaluable in servicing the turbine and jets of the ship. But when the ship had landed and been pillaged... Satisfied, Talman brooded over the reestablishment of the rightful order. The hierarchy had collapsed in the ruins of the cities, but it would be back, strong as ever. Take Flannery, for example. Flannery was nothing but a foul-mouthed, shanty Irish stevedore. But he was in charge of loading the ship, the greatest job at the moment. Flannery was top dog, for the time being. But that would change. It had to change. Consoled, Talman strolled away from Barnes and Masterson, over to the ship itself. The ship was huge. Across its muzzle, the stenciled identification still remained, not yet totally obliterated by drifting ash and the searing heat of the sun. U.S. Army Ordnance, Series A3B. Originally, it had been a high-velocity, massive retaliation weapon, loaded with an H warhead, ready to carry indiscriminate death to the enemy. The projectile had never been launched. Soviet toxic crystals had blown quietly into the windows and doors of the local command barracks. When launching day arrived, there was no crew to send it off. But it didn't matter. There was no enemy either. The rocket had stood on its buttocks for months. It was still there when the first refugees straggled into the shelter of the demolished mountains. "Nice, isn't it?" Patricia Shelby said. She glanced up from her work and smiled blearily at Tellman. Her small, pretty face was streaked with fatigue and eye strain. Sort of like the Trilon at the New York World's Fair. "My God," Tellman said. "You remember that?" "I was only 8, Patricia answered. In the shadow of the ship, she was carefully checking the automatic relays that would maintain the air, temperature, and humidity of the ship. But I'll never forget it. Maybe I was a precog. When I saw it sticking up, I knew someday it would mean a lot to everybody. A lot to the 20 of us, Tellman corrected. Suddenly he offered her the remains of his cigarette. Here, you look like you could use it. Thanks. Patricia continued with her work, the cigarette between her lips. I'm almost done. Boy, some of these relays are tiny. Just think. She held up a microscopic wafer of transparent plastic. While we're all out cold, this makes the difference between life and death. A strange, awed look crept into her dark blue eyes. To the human race. Tellman guffawed. You and Flannery, he's always spouting idealistic twaddle. Professor John Crowley, once head of the history department at Stanford, now the nominal leader of the colony, sat with Flannery and Jean Dobbs, examining the suppurating arm of a 10-year-old boy. Radiation, Crowley was saying emphatically. The overall level is rising daily. It's settling ash that does it. If we don't get out soon, we're done. It's not radiation, Flannery corrected in his ultimately certain voice. It's toxic crystalline poisoning. That stuff's knee-deep up in the hills. He's been playing around up there. Is that so? Jean Dobbs demanded. The boy nodded his head, not daring to look at her. You're right, she said to Flannery. Put some salve on it, Flannery said, and hope he'll live. Outside of sulfathiazole, there's not much we have. He glanced at his watch, suddenly tense. Unless she brings the penicillin today. If she doesn't bring it today, Crowley said, she'll never bring it. This is the last load. As soon as it's stored, we're taking off. Rubbing his hands, Flannery suddenly bellowed, Then get out the money! Crowley grinned. Right. He fumbled in one of the steel storage lockers and yanked out a handful of paper bills. Holding a sheaf of bills up to Tellman, he fanned them out invitingly. Take your pick. Take them all! Nervously, Tellman said, Be careful with that. She's probably raised the price on everything again. We've got plenty. Flannery took some and stuffed it into a partly filled load being wheeled by on its way to the ship. There's money blowing all over the world, along with the ash and particles of bone. On Venus, we won't need it. She might as well have it all. On Venus, Tellman thought savagely, things would revert to their legitimate order, with Flannery digging sewers where he belonged. What's she bringing, mostly? He asked Crowley and Jean Dobbs, ignoring Flannery. What's the last load made up of? Comic books, Flannery said dreamily, wiping perspiration from his balding forehead. He was a lean, tall, dark-haired young man. And harmonicas. Crowley winked at him. You picks, so we can lie in our hammocks all day strumming Someone's in the Kitchen with Dinah. And swizzle sticks, Flannery reminded him, in order that we may all the more properly flatten the bubbles of our vintage 38 champagne. Tellman boiled. You degenerate! Crowley and Flannery roared with laughter, and Telman stalked off, smoldering under this new humiliation. What kind of morons and lunatics were they, joking at a time like this? He peered miserably, almost accusingly, at the ship. Was this the kind of world they were going to found? In the pitiless white-hot sun, the huge ship shimmered and glowed. A vast upright tube of alloy and protective fiber mesh rising up above the tumble of wretched shacks. One more load and they were off. One more truck full of supplies from their only source, the meager trickle of uncontaminated goods that meant the difference between life and death. Praying that nothing would go wrong, Telman turned to await the arrival of Mrs. Edna Berthelsen and her battered red pickup truck. Their fragile umbilical cord connecting them with the opulent, undamaged past. On both sides of the road lay groves of lush apricot trees. Bees and flies buzzed sleepily among the rotting fruit scattered over the soil. Every now and then a roadside stand appeared, operated by somnambulistic children. In driveways stood parked Buicks and Oldsmobiles. Rural dogs wandered here and there. At one intersection stood a swank tavern, its neon sign blinking on and off, ghostly pale in the mid-morning sun. Mrs. Edna Berthelsen glared hostily at the tavern and at the cars parked around it. City people were moving out into the valley, cutting down the old oak trees, the ancient fruit orchards, setting up suburban homes, stopping in the middle of the day for a whiskey sour and then driving cheerfully on. Driving at 75 miles an hour in their swept-back Chryslers, the column of cars that had piled up behind her truck suddenly burst forth and swung past her. She let them go, stony-faced, indifferent, served them right for being in such a hurry. If she always hurried like that, she would never have had time to pay attention to that odd ability she had found in her introspective, lonely drives. Never have discovered that she could look ahead. Never had discovered that hole in the warp of time which enabled her to trade so easily at her own exorbitant prices. Let them hurry if they wanted. The heavy load in the back of the truck jogged rhythmically. The motor wheezed. Against the back window, a half-dead fly buzzed. Jackie lay stretched out among the cartons and boxes, enjoying the ride, gazing complacently at the apricot trees and cars. Against the hot sky, the peak of Mount Diablo rose, blue and white, an expanse of cold rock. Trails of mist clung to the peak. Mount Diablo went a long way up. He made a face at a dog standing indolently at the side of the road, waiting to cross. He waved gaily at a Pacific Telephone Company repairman, stringing wire from a huge reel. Abruptly, the truck turned off the state highway and onto a black-surfaced side road. Now there were fewer cars. The truck began to climb. The rich orchards fell behind and gave way to flat brown fields. A dilapidated farmhouse lay to the right. He watched it with interest, wondering how old it was. When it was out of sight, no other man-made structures followed. The fields became unkempt. Broken, sagging fences were visible occasionally, torn signs no longer legible. The truck was approaching the base of Mount Diablo. Almost nobody came this way. Idly, the boy wondered why Mrs. Berthelsen's little trip took her in this direction. Nobody lived here. Suddenly, there were no fields, only scrub grass and bushes, wild countryside, the tumbled slope of the mountain. A rabbit hopped skillfully across the half-decayed road. Rolling hills, a broad expanse of trees and strewn boulders. There was nothing here but a state fire tower and maybe a watershed. And an abandoned picnic area, once maintained by the state, now forgotten. An edge of fear touched the boy. No customers lived out this way. He had been positive the battered red pickup truck would head directly into town, take him and the load to San Francisco, or Oakland, or Berkeley, a city where he could get out and run around, see the interesting sights. There was nothing here, only abandoned emptiness, silent and foreboding. In the shadow of the mountain, the air was chill. He shivered. All at once, he wished he hadn't come. Mrs. Berthelsen slowed the truck and shifted noisily into low. With a roar and an explosive belch of exhaust gases, the truck crept up a steep ascent among jagged boulders, ominous and sharp. Somewhere far off, a bird cried shrilly. Jackie listened to its thin sounds echoing dismally away and wondered how he could attract his grandmother's attention. It would be nice to be in front, in the cabin. It would be nice. And then he noticed it. At first, he didn't believe it, but he had to believe it. Under him, the truck was beginning to fade away. It faded slowly, almost imperceptibly. Dimmer and dimmer the truck grew. Its rusty red sides became gray, then colorless. The black road was visible underneath. In wild panic, the boy clutched at the piles of boxes. His hands passed through them. He was riding precariously on an uneven sea of dim shapes, among almost invisible phantoms. He lurched and slid down. Now, hideously, he was suspended momentarily halfway through the truck, just above the tailpipe. Groping desperately, he struggled to catch hold of the boxes directly above him. "Help!" he shouted. His voice echoed around him. It was the only sound. The roar of the truck was fading. For a moment he clutched at the retreating shape of the truck. Then, gently, gradually, the last image of the truck faded, and with a sickening crunch, the boy dropped to the road. The impact sent him rolling into the dry weeds beyond the drainage ditch. Stunned, dazed with disbelief and pain, he lay gasping, trying feebly to pull himself up. There was only silence. The truck, Mrs. Berthelsen, had vanished. He was totally alone. He closed his eyes and lay back, stupefied with fright. Sometime later, probably not much later, he was aroused by the squeal of brakes. A dirty orange state maintenance truck had lurched to a stop. Two men in khaki work clothes were climbing down and hurrying over. "What's the matter?" one yelled at him. They grabbed him up, faces serious and alarmed. "What are you doing here?"
"Fell," he muttered, "off the truck."
"What truck?" they demanded. "How?" He couldn't tell them. All he knew was that Mrs. Berthelsen had gone. He hadn't made it after all. Once again, she was making her trip alone. He would never know where she went. He would never find out who her customers were. Gripping the steering wheel of the truck, Mrs. Berthelsen was conscious that the transition had taken place. Vaguely, she was aware that the rolling brown fields, rocks, and green scrub bushes had faded out. The first time she had gone ahead, she had found the old truck floundering in a sea of black ash. She had been so excited by her discovery that day that she had neglected to scan conditions on the other side of the hole. She had known there were customers, and dashed headlong through the warp to get there first. She smiled complacently. She needn't have hurried. There was no competition here. In fact, the customers were so eager to deal with her, they had done virtually everything in their power to make things easier for her. The men had built a crude strip of road out into the ash, a sort of wooden platform onto which the truck now rolled. She had learned the exact moment to go ahead. It was the instant that the truck passed the drainage culvert a quarter mile inside the state park. Here, ahead, the culvert also existed, but there was little left of it, only a vague jumble of shattered stone. And the road was utterly buried. Under the wheels of the truck, the rough boards thumped and banged. It would be bad if she had a flat tire, but some of them could fix it. They were always working. One little additional task wouldn't make much difference. She could see them now. They stood at the end of the wooden platform, waiting impatiently for her. Beyond them was their jumble of crude, smelly shacks, and beyond that, their ship. A lot she cared about their ship. She knew what it was. Stolen army property. Setting her bony hand rigidly around the gear shift knob, she threw the truck into neutral and coasted to a stop. As the men approached, she began pulling on the handbrake. "Afternoon," Professor Crowley muttered, his eyes sharp and keen as he peered eagerly into the back of the truck. Mrs. Berthelsen grunted a noncommittal answer. She didn't like any of them. Dirty men, smelling of sweat and fear, their bodies and clothes streaked with grime, and the ancient coating of desperation that never seemed to leave them. Like awed, pitiful children, they clustered around the truck, poking hopefully at the packages, already beginning to pluck them out onto the black ground. "Here now," she said sharply. "You leave those alone." Their hands darted back as if seared. Mrs. Berthelsen sternly climbed from the truck, grabbed up her inventory sheet, and plodded up to Crowley. "You just wait," she told him. "Those have to be checked off." He nodded, glanced at Masterson, licked his dry lips, and waited. They all waited. It had always been that way. They knew and she knew that there was no other way they could get their supplies. And if they didn't get their supplies, their food and medicine and clothing and instruments and tools and raw materials, they wouldn't be able to leave in their ship. In this world, in the ahead, such things didn't exist. At least, not so anybody could use them. A cursory glance had told her that. She could see the ruin with her own eyes. They hadn't taken very good care of their world. They had wasted it all, turned it into black ash and ruin. Well, it was their business, not hers. She had never been much interested in the relationship between their world and hers. She was content to know that both existed and that she could go from one to the other and back. And she was the only one who knew how. Several times, people from this world, members of this group, had tried to go back there with her. It had always failed. As she made the transition, they were left behind. It was her power, her faculty, not a shared faculty. She was glad of that. And for a person in business, quite a valuable faculty. "All right," she said crisply. Standing where she could keep her eye on them, she began checking off each box as it was carried from the truck. Her routine was exact and certain. It was a part of her life. As long as she could remember, she had transacted business in a distinct way. Her father had taught her how to live in a business world. She had learned his stern principles and rules. She was following them now. Flannery and Patricia Shelby stood together at one side. Flannery held the money, payment for the delivery. "Well," he said under his breath, "now we can tell her to go leap in the river."
"Are you sure?"
Pat asked nervously. "The last load's here." Flannery grinned starkly and ran a trembling hand through his thinning black hair. "Now we can get rolling. With this stuff, the ship's crammed to the gills. We may even have to sit down and eat some of that now." He indicated a bulging pasteboard carton of groceries. "Bacon, eggs, milk, real coffee. Maybe we won't shove it in deep freeze. Maybe we ought to have a last meal before the flight orgy." Wistfully, Pat said, "It would be nice. It's been a long time since we've had food like that." Masterson strode over. "Let's kill her and boil her in a big kettle. Skinny old witch, she might make good soup." "In the oven," Flannery corrected. "Some gingerbread to take along with us."
"I wish you wouldn't talk like that," Pat said apprehensively. "She's so... well, maybe she is a witch. I mean, maybe that's what witches were. Old women with strange talents. Like her, being able to pass through time."
"Damn lucky for us," Masterson said briefly.
"But she doesn't understand it, does she? Does she know what she's doing? That she could save us all by sharing her ability? Does she know what's happened to our world?"
Flannery considered. "Probably she doesn't know or care. A mind like hers, business and profit, getting exorbitant rates from us, selling this stuff to us at an incredible premium. And the joke is that money's worth nothing to us. If she could see, she'd know that. It's just paper in this world. But she's caught in a narrow little routine. Business. Profit." He shook his head. "A mind like that. A warped, miserable, flea-sized mind. And she has that unique talent."
"But she can see," Pat persisted. "She can see the ash, the ruin. How can she not know?"
Flannery shrugged. "She probably doesn't connect it with her own life. After all, she'll be dead in a couple of years. She won't see the war in her real time. She'll only see it this way, as a region into which she can travel, a sort of travelogue of strange lands. She can enter and leave, but we're stuck. It must give you a damn fine sense of security to be able to walk out of one world into another. God, what I'd give to be able to go back with her."
"It's been tried," Masterson pointed out. "That lizard head Talman tried it, and he came walking back, covered with ash. He said the truck faded out."
"Of course it did," Flannery said mildly. "She drove it back to Walnut Creek, back to 1965.
The unloading had been completed. The members of the colony were toiling up the slope, lugging the cartons to the check area beneath the ship. Mrs. Berthelsen strode over to Flannery, accompanied by Professor Crowley.
"Here's the inventory," she said briskly. "A few items couldn't be found. You know, I don't stock all that in my store. I have to send out for most of it."
"We know," Flannery said, coldly amused. "It would be interesting to see a country store that stocked binocular microscopes, turret lathes, frozen packs of antibiotics, high-frequency radio transmitters, advanced textbooks in all fields."
"So that's why I have to charge you a little dearer," the old woman continued, the inflexible routine of squeeze. "On items I bring in..."
She examined her inventory, then returned the 10-page typewritten list that Crowley had given her on the previous visit.
"Some of these weren't available. I marked them back order. That bunch of metals from those laboratories back east, they said maybe later."
A cunning look slid over the ancient gray eyes.
"And they'll be very expensive."
It doesn't matter, Flannery said, handing her the money. You can cancel all the back orders. At first, her face showed nothing, only a vague inability to understand.
No more shipments, Crowley explained.
A certain tension faded from them. For the first time, they weren't afraid of her. The old relationship had ended. They weren't dependent on the rusty red truck. They had their shipment. They were ready to leave.
We're taking off, Flannery said, grinning starkly. We're full up.
Comprehension came.
But I placed orders for those things.
Her voice was thin, bleak, without emotion.
They'll be shipped to me. I'll have to pay for them.
Well, Flannery said softly, isn't that too damn bad? Crowley shot him a warning glance.
Sorry, he said to the old woman. We can't stick around. This place is getting hot. We've got to take off.
On the withered face, dismay turned to growing wrath.
You ordered those things. You have to take them.
Her shrill voice rose to a screech of fury.
What am I supposed to do with them?
As Flannery framed his bitter answer, Pat Shelby intervened.
Mrs. Berthelsen, she said quietly, you've done a lot for us, even if you wouldn't help us through the hole into your time, and we're very grateful. If it wasn't for you, we couldn't have got together enough supplies, but we really have to go.
She reached out her hand to touch the frail shoulder, but the old woman jerked furiously away.
I mean, Pat finished awkwardly, we can't stay any longer, whether we want to or not. Do you see all that black ash? It's radioactive, and more of it sifts down all the time. The toxic level is rising. If we stay any longer, it'll start destroying us.
Mrs. Edna Berthelsen stood clutching her inventory list. There was an expression on her face that none of the group had ever seen before. The violent spasm of wrath had vanished. Now a cold, chill glaze lay over the aged features. Her eyes were like gray rocks, utterly without feeling. Flannery wasn't impressed. Here's your loot, he said, thrusting out the handful of bills. What the hell? He turned to Crowley.
Let's toss in the rest. Let's stuff it down her goddamn throat.
Shut up, Crowley snapped. Flannery sank resentfully back.
Who are you talking to?
Enough's enough.
Crowley, worried and tense, tried to speak to the old woman.
My God, you can't expect us to stay around here forever, can you?
There was no response. Abruptly, the old woman turned and strode silently back to her truck. Masterson and Crowley looked uneasily at each other.
She sure is mad, Masterson said apprehensively.
Tellman hurried up, glanced at the old woman getting into her truck, and then bent down to root around in one of the cartons of groceries. Childish greed flushed across his thin face.
Look, he gasped. Coffee! 15 pounds of it! Can we open some? Can we get one tin open to celebrate?
Sure,
Crowley said tonelessly, his eyes on the truck. With a muffled roar, the truck turned in a wide arc and rumbled off down the crude platform toward the ash. It rolled off into the ash, slithered for a short distance, and then faded out. Only the bleak, sun-swept plain of darkness remained.
Coffee! Tellman shouted gleefully.
He tossed the bright metal can high in the air and clumsily caught it again.
A celebration! Our last night, last meal on Earth!
It was true.
As the red pickup truck jogged metallically along the road, Mrs. Berthelsen scanned ahead and saw that the men were telling the truth. Her thin lips writhed. In her mouth, an acid taste of bile rose. She had taken it for granted that they would continue to buy. There was no competition, no other source of supply. But they were leaving, and when they left, there would be no more market. She would never find a market that satisfactory. It was a perfect market. The group was a perfect customer. In the locked box at the back of the store, hidden down under the reserve sacks of grain, was almost $250,000. A fortune taken in over the months, received from the imprisoned colony as it toiled to construct its ship. And she had made it possible. She was responsible for letting them get away, after all. Because of her short-sightedness, they were able to escape. She hadn't used her head. As she drove back to town, she meditated calmly, rationally. It was totally because of her. She was the only one who had possessed the power to bring them their supplies. Without her, they were helpless. Hopefully, she cast about, looking this way and that, peering with her deep inner sense into the various aheads. There was more than one, of course. The aheads lay like a pattern of squares, an intricate web of worlds into which she could step, if she cared. But all were empty of what she wanted. All showed bleak plains of black ash, devoid of human habitation. What she wanted was lacking. They were each without customers. The patterns of aheads was complex. Sequences were connected like beads on a string. There were chains of aheads which formed interwoven links. One step led to the next, but not to alternate chains. Carefully, with great precision, she began the job of searching through each of the chains. There were many of them, a virtual infinity of possible aheads. And it was her power to select. She had stepped into that one, the particular chain in which the huddled colony had labored to construct its ship. She had, by entering it, made it manifest, frozen it into reality, dredged it up from among the many, from among the multitude of possibilities. Now she needed to dredge another. That particular ahead had proven unsatisfactory. The market had petered out. The truck was entering the pleasant town of Walnut Creek, passing bright stores and houses and supermarkets, before she located it. There were so many, and her mind was old. But now she had picked it out. As soon as she found it, she knew it was the one. Her innate business instinct certified it. The particular ahead clicked. Of the possibilities, this one was unique. The ship was well built and thoroughly tested. In ahead after ahead, the ship rose, hesitated as automatic machinery locked, and then burst from the jacket of atmosphere toward the morning star. In a few aheads, the wasted sequences of failure, the ship exploded into white-hot fragments. Those she ignored. She saw no advantage in that. In a few aheads, the ship failed to take off at all. The turbines lashed, exhaust poured out, and the ship remained as it was. But then the men scampered out and began going over the turbines, searching for the faulty parts. So nothing was gained. In later segments along the chain, in subsequent links, the damage was repaired and the takeoff was satisfactorily completed. But one chain was correct. Each element, each link, developed perfectly. The pressure locks closed, and the ship was sealed. The turbines fired, and the ship, with a shudder, rose from the plain of black ash. 3 miles up, the rear jets tore loose. The ship floundered, dropped in a screaming dive, and plunged back toward the Earth. Emergency landing jets, designed for Venus, were frantically thrown on. The ship slowed, hovered for an agonizing instant, and then crashed into the heap of rubble that had been Mount Diablo. There the remains of the ship lay, twisted metal sheets, smoking in the dismal silence. From the ship the men emerged, shaken and mute, to inspect the damage, to begin the miserable, futile task all over again, collecting supplies, patching the rocket up. The old woman smiled to herself. That was what she wanted. That would do perfectly. And all she had to do, such a little thing, was select that sequence when she made her next trip, when she took her little business trip the following Saturday. Crowley lay half buried in the black ash, pawing feebly at a deep gash in his cheek. A broken tooth throbbed. A thick ooze of blood dripped into his mouth, the hot, salty taste of his own body fluids leaking helplessly out. He tried to move his leg, but there was no sensation. Broken. His mind was too dazed, too bewildered with despair to comprehend. Somewhere in the half-darkness, Flannery stirred. A woman groaned, scattered among the rocks and buckled sections of the ship, lay the injured and dying. An upright shape rose, stumbled, and pitched over. An artificial light flickered. It was Telman, making his way clumsily over the tattered remains of their world. He gaped foolishly at Crowley. His glasses hung from one ear, and part of his lower jaw was missing. Abruptly he collapsed, face forward into a smoking mound of supplies. His skinny body twitched aimlessly. Crowley managed to pull himself to his knees. Masterson was bending over him, saying something again and again. "I'm all right," Crowley rasped. "We're down. Wrecked." "I know." On Masterson's shattered face glittered the first stirrings of hysteria. "Do you think—" "No," Crowley muttered. "It isn't possible." Masterson began to giggle. Tears streaked the grime of his cheeks. Drops of thick moisture dripped down his neck into his charred collar. "She did it. She fixed us. She wants us to stay here." "No," Crowley repeated. He shut out the thought. It couldn't be. It just couldn't. "We'll get away," he said. "We'll assemble the remains. Start over." "She'll be back," Masterson quavered. "She knows we'll be here waiting for her. Customers." "No," Crowley said. He didn't believe it. He made himself not believe it. "We'll get away. We've got to get away." Note: Captive Market, October 18, 1954. If, April 1955. End note.